2. Eugene, Oregon, 2010. Zoraida knew the apartment was haunted the first time she stepped through the doorway. Kelsey, on the other hand, was completely clueless, and it was only because their relationship was so young and in such a fragile transitional stage that Zoraida hadn't put her foot down and insist they find someplace else to live. She'd given up her own rented duplex when Kelsey, on a whim, had suggested the two of them move in together. But Kelsey's apartment had proved too small, and after a week, they both decided that, since they each had a lot of stuff, they needed a place with more rooms. It was Kelsey's ex, Shari, who said she knew of a two-bedroom apartment that was near downtown with reasonable rent. Zoraida wondered now if Shari's suggestion had been part of an intentional effort to get back at Kelsey. "This'll definitely work," Kelsey had said happily, walking with the landlord through the open rooms. And against her better instincts, Zoraida had agreed. She wished she had spoken up at the time. They'd been here a month already, and there was not a single night that she'd been able to sleep more than 4 hours. Kelsey was oblivious. Invigorated by a new bedroom, she initiated lovemaking almost every night, although Zoraida had grown increasingly inhibited. She couldn't shake the feeling that they were being watched, and while Kelsey wanted to stretch out in bed and try new things, she just wanted to hurry up and get it over with. Afterward, Kelsey would fall instantly asleep, snoring within minutes, and would remain dead to the world until morning, while Zoraida found it almost impossible to fall asleep. Only after hours of tossing and turning would her exhausted body finally give in and allow her to drift into a light, easily interrupted doze. Haunted. She wished she had a reason for her feelings, but she didn't. She hadn't seen anything, hadn't heard anything, had only felt a sort of vague unease. She was certain that the apartment was haunted, but didn't know how, didn't know why, and on Thursdays, when their schedules diverged, when Kelsey was at work and she was at home alone, she would walk from room to room, trying to figure out what was wrong and where it was centered. Sometimes she'd start in their bedroom at the rear of the apartment, but more often than not, she'd start at the front door, trying to recreate her initial impression of the place. She'd walk slowly through the front room, past the couch, past the TV, into the small kitchen with its even smaller breakfast nook, then back out into the front room and into the microscopic hallway, peeking into the bathroom, opening the shower curtain to make sure nothing was behind it, checking out the room that was their shared office. She'd end up in the bedroom, on the bed, looking around, wondering how anything so normal could feel so wrong. The only time that anything close to concrete occurred was one Saturday, at lunch. They were both home, crammed into their tiny breakfast nook, eating macaroni and cheese.
"Do you think time's speeding up?" Kelsey asked.
Zoraida was getting used to her girlfriend's idiosyncrasies. What would have once seemed a bizarre left-field query that had nothing to do with anything, she now took in stride as a normal topic of conversation.
"Not really. Why?"
"I always heard that things seemed to go by more quickly when you got older, that a kid's summers seemed to last longer than an adult's. But my whole life's gone by quickly. I never had a slow period. There were no endless summers for me. They all sped by. I'm wondering if the same thing's true for you, for everyone our age. If we didn't have those slow years like other generations, because time's speeding up."
The phone rang at that moment, and since Zoraida was closer, she reached over and grabbed the handset from the wall.
"Hello?"
The voice at the other end of the line sounded as though it was coming from an old Victrola. There was the same foreground crackle and hiss, the same faint tinny timbre to the spoken words.
"I'm lost."
It was a woman speaking, sounding plaintive even from so far away.
"I'm lost."
Zoraida hung up quickly.
"Who was it?"
Kelsey asked. Zoraida shivered.
"I don't know."
Her girlfriend frowned.
"What did they say?"
"It was a woman. And she just kept repeating, 'I'm lost,' in this creepy, otherworldly kind of voice."
"Prank call," Kelsey determined. "Don't worry about it."
Zoraida did not think it was a prank,
but she wasn't sure what it was.
Kelsey had already forgotten about the call, and she tried to forget about it too. But she couldn't. Remembrance of that tinny voice recurred throughout the day. And going to bed that night, she was glad she wasn't alone. Glad Kelsey was here with her. On the 2-month anniversary of their moving in together, they attended a diversity rally downtown, a protest against news coverage of public policy by both the local and national media, which left Asians and Latinos out of nearly every discussion of race. As a Filipino-American, Zoraida was tired of not being part of the cultural conversation, and she thought it was long past time that when matters of race were addressed, when poverty or education reform or crime statistics were discussed, the media did not just poll whites and African Americans about their opinions. As impossible as it would have been to believe 10 years ago, these days her sexuality gave her a better seat at the table than her ethnicity. And one of the purposes of this rally was to draw attention to the entire spectrum of the rainbow that lived in the United States. After signing petitions and listening to a host of activist speakers on the college campus where the rally was to start, the entire group of 500-plus began marching downtown, taking a strategic route that passed by the local ABC, NBC, CBS, and Fox affiliates. "Diversity's not just black and white," they chanted. "Diversity's not just black and white." They added to their numbers as they moved through the city and got a lot of honking support from passing motorists, but there really was no planned ending. And after chanting in front of City Hall for the benefit of reporters and cameramen covering the event for the 6 o'clock newscasts, people just started gradually drifting away. Zoraida and Kelsey had run into some mutual friends, and after walking back to the campus in their cars, the six of them went out for drinks and dinner. They didn't get back until late, and the second they walked through the doorway into the apartment, Zoraida knew something had changed. They hadn't expected to be gone so long, and hadn't left any lights on. The apartment was dark when they entered, and even after Kelsey had reached around to find the wall switch next to the door. The front room had no ceiling light, so the switch was connected to an outlet and turned on a standing lamp next to the television. They'd recently replaced the lamp's burned-out bulb with one that was more eco-friendly, and though Zoraida had not noticed the difference until now, she saw that the glow given off was weaker and yellower than the bright white of before. There were far too many shadows in the room. She glanced over at Kelsey to see if she was noticing anything unusual, and was chilled to see a look of apprehension on her girlfriend's face. This was real. There was another lamp on the end table next to the couch, and Kelsey instinctively hurried over to turn it on. Zoraida went into the kitchen to turn on the lights in there. But that was where they stopped. Neither of them, it seemed, wanted to go into that short hallway, or the bathroom, or the office, or the bedroom. They looked at each other. Kelsey laughed a little to cut the tension, but it wasn't a real laugh, and it didn't work. The feeling, whatever it was still here. And Zoraida picked up the remote to turn on the television, needing to hear a little noise in the apartment. She heard more noise than she wanted. They both heard it. Above the irritating Access Hollywood music on the television came a high-pitched whine so loud that it hurt their ears. It was not electronic, but did not sound natural either. Zoraida could think of nothing that could possibly make that squeal, and her impulse was to turn around and leave, get out of the apartment as quickly as possible. Then the sound disappeared, the lights went out, the television switched off, the apartment was thrown into darkness. And suddenly, the source of the uneasiness they'd felt when they'd walked through the door, the cause of the haunting that had disturbed Zoraida's sleep ever since they'd moved in, was right there before them. It wasn't invisible. Wasn't even some vague amorphous shape. It was an old Asian man, a short dark figure wearing what looked like green pajamas. Glowing, lit from within, he was rocking back and forth on his bare heels, laughing through a mouth crowded with crooked overlapping teeth. His laughter was silent. No sound emerged from that open maw. And his eyes burned with a malevolent ferocity that was the furthest thing possible from mirth.
The juxtaposition of the hatred in those eyes and that wide laughing mouth was not merely unsettling, but terrifying. Screaming, practically knocking each other over in their efforts to escape, like two characters in a primitive slapstick comedy, they ran from the apartment, instinctively trying to get as far away from that ghost figure as quickly as possible, although Kelsey did take the time to close and lock the door behind them before fleeing to the car. Rent was paid up through the end of the month, but they moved out the next day. They'd spent the night, in separate bedrooms, in Kelsey's parents' house, and in the morning they gathered together what friends and family they could, and with a rented U-Haul, returned to the apartment complex. Zoraida's brother Alex was the first one inside, and they let him scope out the place to make sure it was empty before either of them entered. Assured that the rooms were clear, the rest of them swarmed in and, as quickly as they could, carried away the furniture, boxed up the possessions, and cleaned everything out. 2 days later, they were installed in a new apartment, an apartment that actually was new, close to the college. And that should have been the end of it. But it wasn't. While they did not see the Asian man again, they both experienced incidents. This place was smaller, smaller than Zoraida's old duplex, which made her wish she had never moved out. There was only one bedroom, and the apartment was sparsely furnished, since half of their belongings were now crowding Kelsey's parents' garage. But whatever had been behind the events in their old place seemed to have followed them here. The television now turned off and on at will, as did the light in the kitchen, though both of them pretended not to notice, and neither of them mentioned anything about it. Kelsey did mention the fact that she sometimes heard voices coming from the closet, what sounded like a man and a woman talking low in order to keep from being overheard. It happened both when she was by herself and when Zoraida was with her, though Zoraida heard nothing. And whenever Kelsey pulled open the closet door, the voices stopped, and there was never anything there. But it was Zoraida who had it the worst. Waking up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom the week after they'd moved in, she flipped on the light and saw what she thought was a face in the toilet, the reflection of a leering old man looking up at her from the water. The man grinned at her and winked. After that, she was afraid to go to the bathroom in the apartment by herself. Kelsey had to check first and then stay in there with her. If Kelsey was gone, she would hold it until she went to work, or if necessary, use the bathroom at the McDonald's down the street. All of this put a strain on the relationship. Their formerly vigorous lovemaking trailed off to nothing, and even casual displays of affection like kisses goodbye and hugs somehow fell by the wayside without either of them noticing. Then, one day, Kelsey was gone. Zoraida awoke in the morning to find that her girlfriend was not there. She thought little of it at first, assuming that Kelsey had merely left early for work and had rudely not informed her. But when she came back to the apartment that night to find Kelsey still gone, when a call to Kelsey's cell not only rang and rang, but did not go into voicemail, Zoraida knew something was wrong. Her hope was that Kelsey had just needed a little space and was taking a few days off, or even that Kelsey was breaking up with her and leaving. She was afraid that something bad had happened. Kelsey's parents did not know where she was when Zoraida called, were not even aware she was missing, and for Zoraida, that was the last straw. She immediately called the police, and two detectives came to the apartment to get her statement. They took a photo of Kelsey, looked around to make sure there were no signs of foul play, then left her with a case number and told her they would be in touch. They were in touch the next day, when the same two policemen arrived not to follow up on a report, but to drag her down to the station for questioning.
"I don't understand how you can bring me in," she said in the car. "I haven't done anything."
That was when one of the detectives let slip that she was being questioned at the behest of Kelsey's mom and dad, who apparently blamed her for their daughter's disappearance. The police had been filled with homophobic falsehoods from the family, and Zoraida realized that the tolerance she'd experienced from Kelsey's parents up to this point was only the thinnest of veneers. She'd seen enough movies and TV shows to know that she shouldn't answer any questions without the presence of a lawyer. But she didn't have a lawyer, didn't even know how to go about finding one,
and all the way to the station, she obsessed over whether she would have to sit in a cell and wait until a lawyer showed up. What she learned at the station, when she was in an interrogation room and cameras were trained on her, was that Kelsey was dead. Her body had been found this morning next to a forest control road by a mountain biker. The cyclist had been speeding down the dirt trail when he'd noticed what looked like a naked woman lying in the adjacent runoff ditch. He'd braked to a halt, circled back, and found the bruised and battered body of what was almost immediately determined by law enforcement, once the bicyclist had called them, to be Kelsey Edwards. "Hope for the best, expect the worst," was a motto Zoraida had always claimed to live by. But this was the worst, and she found that she hadn't expected it, and definitely wasn't prepared for it. She sat there, stunned, acutely aware that the detectives were watching her reaction. Instead of being allowed to honestly respond to the news, she was under scrutiny, forced to wonder if she was acting in a sufficiently innocent manner. And she burst into tears, not only at the thought that Kelsey was dead, but also from the stress of being under suspicion of murder. Murder? It didn't even seem possible. She thought of Kelsey, her brain forcing her to imagine what her girlfriend's body, her beautiful body, had looked like crumpled up by the side of the road, beaten, bloody, and black and blue. Zoraida's sobs intensified. Who could have hurt her? And why? She'd been stripped. Had she been assaulted as well? Entered against her will by some gross pig? One of the detectives, the older one, a stern, no-nonsense-looking guy, told her wearily that this was just pro forma, that she wasn't really a suspect, that they had to do this, and the sooner she answered their questions, the sooner they could all get out of here. She knew she was innocent, knew none of her responses would implicate her, and she decided to answer honestly. If it looked like they were trying to trick her into saying something incriminating, she'd shut up. But if she could clear up any suspicions they had about her, they would be free to pursue the real murderer. The questions were generic. Where was she at this time? At that time? Had she and Kelsey had a fight? Did she know of any enemies Kelsey might have had? What disturbed her most about the interview, what really brought it home to her, was the way the detectives kept referring to Kelsey in the past tense. Kelsey didn't exist anymore. She was dead. And though the rest of the world seemed to have caught on to that fact, Zoraida's brain was still a step behind. And the words remained jarring. She was released fairly quickly, and she returned to the apartment feeling numb. The first thing she noticed when she walked inside was how many of their furnishings and possessions were Kelsey's. The sight of a book her girlfriend had been reading, lying on top of the end table, made her burst into tears again, and she plopped down on the couch feeling overwhelmed. Were Kelsey's parents planning a funeral? If so, would she be invited? To her knowledge, Kelsey had no will. Why would she? She was only 26. So what would happen to her belongings? Would they go back to her parents? Kelsey's name was on the rental agreement. How was that going to work? There were too many things to consider, and Zoraida felt completely unprepared to deal with any of them. It was the middle of the day, but she felt tired and just wanted to go to bed. Part of her thought that maybe if she went to sleep and woke up, she would find that this had all been a dream, that everything was back to normal. She knew that was wishful thinking, but she also thought that it couldn't hurt to try, and she dragged herself into the bedroom, fell onto the bed, and pulled the covers over her head. The pillow still smelled like Kelsey. She dozed off, crying, and when she awoke several hours later, it was dark, and Kelsey was still dead. It hadn't been a dream. She tried to fall back asleep again, but couldn't. And after a half hour of tossing and turning, she sat up, feeling hungry, intending to go into the kitchen and get something to eat. Then she saw it. There in the dark corner, looking at her, a small huddled figure with the face of a wrinkled old woman.
Screaming, Zoraida ran from the bedroom, outside, into the courtyard of the complex. Lights were turning on, other people coming out of their apartments to see what was going on, perhaps thinking there was a fire. Luckily, Zoraida had fallen asleep with her clothes on, but she didn't even care about that at the moment. All she cared about was getting away from that thing, and she ignored her emerging neighbors, running all the way out to the street before stopping. She bent over, breathing deeply. What the hell was she going to do now? She wasn't going back, that's for sure. And she certainly couldn't expect to stay with Kelsey's family. Maybe she'd be able to crash at a friend's house for a night or two, just until she could sort things out. Her purse, car keys, and pocketbook were back in the apartment. Zoraida's heart dropped as the realization came to her. She hurried back into the courtyard. Maybe some of her neighbors were still out, still curious about what was happening. She didn't really know any of them, but one or two of the braver men might be willing to accompany her back inside while she picked up her purse. It was on the floor next to the magazine rack, if she wasn't mistaken. That's where she usually dropped it, before plopping herself down on the couch. She'd be able to get in and out quickly. She looked at the open door of the apartment. The idea of seeing that thing again terrified her. She didn't know what it was or why it was there, but it frightened her even more than the ghost of the Asian man had, and she wasn't sure she had the strength to face it. Most of her neighbors had gone back indoors. The fireworks were over. There was nothing to see, no reason to stay outside. But an older man in the apartment above theirs, hers, was leaning against the railing, smoking. He looked down as she entered the courtyard. She didn't know his name, was not even sure she'd seen him before, but she stopped, addressing him.
Hi, I'm Zoraida. I live in the apartment below you.
Heard you screaming. Saw you running out, he said. He took a long, slow drag on his cigarette. What was that about?
I think someone's in my apartment. I was wondering if you could just walk in there with me. I need to get my purse and just in case.
He looked at her disinterestedly.
Call the police.
He pinched the end of his cigarette, then flicked it down at her and turned to go back into his apartment.
Asshole!
She called out. His apartment door closed. She considered knocking on another door, asking someone else to help her, but the brief confrontation had boosted her courage, and she thought she'd be able to do this herself. She'd just rush in, take the two steps to her purse, grab it, and run. Besides, that thing was in the bedroom. She wouldn't even have to see it. Fear gripped her as she approached the open doorway. It was dark inside. She'd fallen asleep when it was day and hadn't turned on any lights. Gathering what was left of her rapidly dwindling courage, she reached the doorway and stretched her arm around the side of the jamb, reaching for the light switch. Maybe it's gone, she told herself. Maybe I imagined it. She flipped on the light, intending to grab her purse and go. But there it was. It had moved to the sitting room. Still in a corner, it was shaking, vibrating, and there was a toothless smile on the wrinkled old woman face. Something pushed her from behind, knocking her forward. The door slammed shut. Zoraida's hands landed on her purse, breaking her fall. She heard something crunch inside. Sunglasses? Tic Tacs? Then she was pushing herself to her feet, grabbing the purse. The small, huddled figure was next to her, its wrinkled face looking up into her own. She was alive until it touched her. Kimber Edwards looked at her husband, mouth set in a straight, hard line. Didn't I tell you? When Kelsey first got involved with all those lesbians, didn't I say things would turn out this way? I knew it. I knew it! But no, you knew better. Leave her alone, you said. Let her find her own way. Well, are you happy now, huh? Are you happy? If you hadn't allowed her to—
Shut up!
Kimber blinked, stunned into silence. She could not recall the last time Tom had raised his voice to her, and his outburst cut her off in mid-diatribe. She narrowed her eyes.
What did you say?
Shut up!
There was danger in his expression. and the thought crossed her mind that if she continued, he might hit her. But that was crazy. Tom? Hit her? He couldn't hit anyone.
You're the one,
she began.
I told you to shut up!
He pushed her back on the couch, hard. She bumped her head on the wall behind the sofa, causing a framed photo of Kelsey to fall. But before she could even cry out, he was pulling down his pants, and she saw that he was harder than he'd been in years. She was both shocked and disgusted. How could he be aroused at a moment like this? Their daughter was dead, for God's sake. It was not only nauseating, it was incomprehensible. You sick, she began. He grabbed her midsection in mid-sentence, roughly flipping her over and pushing up her dress, ripping her underwear. Furious, she tried to get up. Then his weight was on her, and she couldn't move. What are you? In one brutal movement, he forced his hardness inside her, intentionally shoving it up the wrong hole. No! She screamed at the top of her lungs, but he rammed it in deeper and began pounding away. She cried out in pain. It felt as though she was being ripped apart, but his hand went over her mouth to muffle the sound, and he continued thrusting so violently that she thought she would pass out. There was a disgusting grunt of release in her ear. His body stiffened as he finished, and then he was finally off her, pulling his pants back up. She could feel that she was bleeding back there, and wasn't even sure she'd be able to stand. But she managed to roll over and stagger to her feet. The pain was unbearable, and she hobbled, sobbing, into the bathroom, where she locked the door and sat on the toilet, mingled sperm and blood dripping into the water below. She didn't know how long she sat there, but morning became afternoon, and afternoon became evening. Throughout the day, she could hear Tom moving around the house, but he never spoke to her, and she didn't call out to him. She heard the microwave bell and smelled reheated chili when he made his lunch, heard the microwave ding again later, and smelled the hot dogs he made for dinner. He made no effort to use the bathroom, though they had just the one, and she wondered if he was holding it, going outside in the backyard or pissing in the kitchen sink. The thought made Kimber's stomach churn. The bleeding had stopped for the most part, but she knew she still might need medical treatment. She would have herself checked out later, but for now, she'd gooped a bunch of Neosporin on her finger and gently slathered it in and around the hole. What was going to happen when she had to poop? Would that open the wounds again? Would everything get infected? She didn't even want to think about it. Tom had not interrupted his after-dinner routine for her. She could hear from the front of the house the muffled sound of the television. And several hours later, probably after he'd fallen asleep in his chair and woken up several times, the TV finally shut off. She heard him coming down the hall. The bathroom door was locked, and she braced herself against it, just in case he tried to force his way in. But he passed by and went into the bedroom, where she heard the rattle of his belt buckle, the thump of his shoes hitting the floor. He was getting ready for bed, and moments later, there was no sound at all as he lay down and tried to fall asleep. Kimber had turned on the lights in the bathroom when it started to get dark outside, but the lights were dimmer now than they had been. In fact, they seemed to be fading by the minute, as though they were connected to a dying generator whose power was gradually diminishing. She didn't see how that was possible, but it was happening, and she tried to look through the frosted glass window to find out whether any of her neighbors' homes were being similarly affected. Movement glimpsed out of the corner of her eye caused her to turn, and in the mirror over the sink, she saw the reflection of a figure that wasn't in the room. Startled, she sucked in her breath. She thought her heart would burst through her chest, and for a moment, she even forgot the pain and what had happened to her. She almost called out for Tom, but stopped herself at the last second. He was real. This was not. He could actually hurt her. Well, this was merely a reflection. Of what, though? She wanted to believe it was a figment of her imagination, but it was still there.
even though she'd looked away and looked back.
She hoped that it was a misperception on her part. The confluence of objects in the bathroom that looked like a figure when viewed from a certain angle. But she changed angles, moved closer, and it was still there. In fact, the figure had the face of an old lady, and it reminded her of someone. She couldn't think of who at the moment, though it came to her later. The wife of Mr. Wilbert, the handyman who'd built their back patio. At that instant, however, she was too scared to think about whose appearance the phantom resembled. Her priority was getting out of the bathroom and away from that thing without waking Tom in the bedroom. And then it spoke. Just as she thought of Tom, it spoke.
"Kill him,"
the old lady mouth whispered. There were scissors on the counter next to the sink, the scissors she occasionally used to trim her bangs. She didn't remember putting them there. Hadn't trimmed her bangs for a while. But she picked them up and looked at them in the dim half light. Kimber glanced up at the thing in the mirror. It was grinning. As if on autopilot, she unlocked the door and walked out of the bathroom. The hallway was dark, but there was a blue light coming from the bedroom. The TV. Tom couldn't fall asleep without that flickering light, though he always turned the sound off because he also needed silence. She walked into the room. He was on his stomach, in his underwear, the covers pushed down, dead to the world. Dead. She held the scissors above his bare back for several minutes. But in the end, she couldn't do it. She hated him, yes. But she realized as she stood there that she didn't want to live without him. She didn't want to sleep in an empty bed. She didn't want to go to jail either, but that wasn't even part of the consideration. She was at that moment in a world with no legal consequences, where she was free to act as she pleased, and though her rectum was still bleeding, though she was still in terrible pain, she decided to let him live. Taking a deep breath, Kimber returned to the bathroom to put away the scissors. The lights were again at full power, and the only person reflected in the mirror now was herself. Back in the bedroom, she took off her clothes, put on her nightgown, and crawled into bed. She faced Tom, still not comfortable with turning her back to him, but it was nice to feel his warm body next to hers. When she awoke in the morning, he was gone. Was he consulting with the police to see if they'd found Kelsey's killer? Had he headed off to work? Was he down at Dunkin' Donuts getting coffee? None of those felt right. He was gone. And she knew he was gone. But she decided to wait a few days to see if he came back before reporting him as missing. Getting out of bed, Kimber walked over to the bathroom. There was nothing in the mirror, though the scissors were again on top of the counter. Had she put them back in the drawer? She thought so, but couldn't remember. For some reason, apropos of nothing, she found herself wondering what had happened to the vial of Billy Bob Thornton's blood that Angelina Jolie used to carry around with her. Had it been thrown away? Or was it sitting around somewhere, growing moldy, turning into something? She'd probably never know. There were a lot of things she'd never know. Staring into the mirror, Kimber looked for the figure, but it was not there, not standing in the foreground as it had been before, or hiding in the background. It was not in the shower, not in the window. It was nowhere to be seen. And she stood in that same spot and stared that way many times over the following days, weeks, and months, patiently waiting for the figure to come back. But it never did.